Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin. I want to start briefly with a couple of housekeeping details. Basically, a reminder that you can subscribe to our podcast series on iTunes or the Zune Network, or alternatively use our RSS feed to connect with any different MP3 system that you might have. I know we have a few problems still with some of the MP3 players out there, and we're trying to fix those problems, so bear with us. Also, don't forget to check out our Facebook page and like us. We are also setting up an area for discussion on that page for those of you who would like to comment on any of our episodes. The common feature on our regular home site page is currently being overwhelmed with spam, and we're trying to fix that problem, so it's probably better to use the Facebook page for the short time here. Finally, if you have any comments or suggestions or questions and you'd like to see some guests or specific topics, I'd love to hear from you. So please feel free to email me at tgill@uw.edu. That's tgill, T-G-I-L-L, at uw.edu. Okay, today's program picks up where we left off last week. And for those of you who are not regular listeners, we were joined by Carmel Chiswick, who took us on a historical journey of American Jews, focusing on their economic and educational mobility and how that influenced a variety of Jewish religious practices. Near the end of that interview, Professor Chiswick brought up the issue of Jewish political affiliations, and I had to stop her short, well, because first we were running a bit late, but more importantly, I actually had another guest in mind to address that topic specifically. That guest is Professor Ken Wald, and he joins me today. Ken is a distinguished professor of political science at the University of Florida and is the author of a number of books, including The Politics of Gay Rights, The Politics of Cultural Differences, Social Change and Voter Mobilization Strategies in the Post-New Deal Period, and Religion and Politics in the United States, a widely read textbook that is currently in its sixth edition. Professor Wald is also the co-editor, along with David Leagy, of the Cambridge Studies in Social Theory, Religion, and Politics, where my most recent book appeared, so I'm very grateful for his support in my scholarly development. Ken, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thanks very much, Tony. It's great to be here.
Let me start off by confirming a rumor that I heard, that you are going to give up the sunny climate of Florida and head up to the cold and snowy climate of Michigan in the coming year.
True as charged, I'm going to be heading off to Ann Arbor, Michigan, in mid-August and spend the fall semester in residence at the Frankel Institute for Advanced Jewish Studies. Even though it seems kind of extreme, it's not as bad as my last sabbatical, where we actually left Florida in January for Boston. I now understand why very few people do that. So
yeah,
hopefully the fall won't be quite as bad.
It's usually the other way around. So
exactly.
Having grown up in Wisconsin, when you say, well, the fall in Michigan can't be that bad, just be a little bit forewarned. You might be surprised. So we'll see what happens there. What are you going to be doing up there at that center?
Well, I'm actually going to be working on a book that I have been working on intermittently for the past few years, precisely about Jewish political behavior.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to call the book The Choosing People as a clever pun, but that title was actually used by a book published in the 1960s about Israeli political behavior. So the book will have a more prosaic title, I'm afraid.
Oh, well, you can always take somebody else's title. I've seen many books that have similar titles, so... Well, we'll be looking forward to that, and actually what you'll be working on here, you've already started doing some of the research for, and that's what we want to talk about on today's podcast. And so I recently ran across a paper that you wrote for the ARDA's Guiding Paper Series, and we've mentioned the ARDA before on our podcast. It's sponsored out of Penn State, and the Guiding Paper Series really tries to bring together a number of prominent scholars from around the country on different topics of religion to have them talk about their specific areas of interest. And your paper was entitled The Puzzling Politics of American Jewry. Now, that paper is free to the public, and we'll provide a link on our website so that those of you who are interested in reading it can download it. And in that paper, what you do is you lay out three somewhat counterintuitive observations about the political attitudes and behavior of American Jews. I want to discuss each one of those paradoxes or puzzles in depth, but I think it'd be useful if you gave us a quick summary of each so that our listeners would know where we're heading.
Sure. The paper was really my sketching of the theoretical framework for the project and the book that I'm working on. Again, I'm one of those political scientists who likes to solve puzzles. And the puzzle that I was drawn to is, the big puzzle, is what I sometimes call the Himmelfarb puzzle, after the late Milton Himmelfarb. Writing in the 1970s in Commentary magazine, he once famously stated that American Jews earn like Episcopalians, but vote like Puerto Ricans. Mm. And what he meant by that politically incorrect phrase was that American Jews have the socioeconomic profile of groups that are normally prone to vote Republican and hold conservative positions on the core questions of public policy. Yet politically, they tend to vote for Democrats and liberals and hold very liberal political views. So it's puzzling that a group that has the economic profile of conservatives would actually tend to behave in a very liberal political manner. And that's really the central question that that many scholars have thought about.
Okay, so that's the first one, and we'll take a look at that a little bit more in depth. But then you say that there's two other ones that emanate from that puzzle itself. What are those, briefly?
Right. Well, briefly, the second problem, which to my mind makes the previous explanations of the Himmelfarb problematic themselves, is what I call the comparative problem. And that is to say, the particular behavior we're talking about, voting far to the left of the country as a whole, turns out not to be something that Jews do everywhere, but is fairly uniquely concentrated in the United States. If you look at Jewish communities in countries with democratic political systems, you don't find any others that have the American pattern of voting well to the left. You have a lot of variety, which we can talk about. So that's what I call the comparative problem, number mm-hmm. two. And then there's the third problem, which I call the temporal or time-based problem. Most discussions of American Jewish political behavior tend to assume that this liberal political orientation is constant over time, that Jews have always and forever tend to vote liberal and hold more liberal political positions. But when you actually look at the voting data, it's clear that there are certain times and periods when that has not been the case. If you just go back starting in the 1930s, there's a period from the 1970s through the late 1980s when the gap between Jews and non-Jews and their political behavior narrowed quite dramatically. And then there's a period after that in the late 90s where it scissored back apart and looks more like the patterns you saw in the 1940s than the patterns you saw in the 1970s. Mm-hmm. So again, if Jews are liberal, what explains this variation over time? So it's really both that comparative problem, that temporal problem, that seemed to me to suggest we need new thoughts about why Jews hold the political views they do.
Okay, and you have a really great theoretical explanation that weaves these three different puzzles together, which really puts a number of the alternative explanations into context, or I should say puts them to shame, because some of the alternative explanations can maybe explain one of the puzzles but not the others. So we're going to get to that explanation, but let's go ahead and take each of these puzzles here one at a time. And let's start with the first puzzle, the relative liberalism of American Jews compared to most other voting blocs. And that's one that I don't think would come as a big surprise to any observers of public opinion polls. I mean, it's fairly common knowledge that Jews tend to vote overwhelmingly for the Democratic Party in federal and state elections. So give us an idea of how big that liberal skew is in opinion polls relative to other groups and how that affects their voting behavior.
Right. Well, let me just point out that identifying Jews and their voting patterns with precision is challenging, because we are, after all, talking about a relatively small share of the American public, And typically, unless you have very large surveys, you're going to get a relative handful of Jews, which makes it a challenge to really document that. But the surveys I've looked at tend to be very large and therefore generate good-sized Jewish samples. If you go for the entire period from 1948 through 2008 in presidential election alone, you'll find that across the United States, the average Democratic share of the presidential vote for that entire period is 47%. If you look at just Jewish respondents, the average Democratic share is actually 74%.
Mm-hmm.
And typically, Jews are 20 to 30% on average more likely to support the Democratic presidential candidate than is true of non-Jews. And when you look at other political attitudes, particularly those on economic policy questions, social justice issues, and the like, you will tend to find, again, that Jews are demonstrably more liberal across the board than is true of most other other groups, particularly those who they resemble socioeconomically.
Yeah, talk about that socioeconomic aspect, too. And you mentioned this a little bit earlier, but it fits very well with Carmel Chiswick's podcast, which we'll, again, put a link to on our website, that Jews, they should be voting Republican or conservative. Why is that socioeconomically?
Well, the it's one of the funny things about our discipline of political science that we're not in the United States typically Marxists, but our understanding of elections and political behavior has a kind of a Marxist orientation to it in this assumption that people vote primarily based on their economic interests. And that has traditionally meant that affluent people tend to vote more for conservative parties because the policies they typically pursue, low taxes, limited regulation, and so forth, help to reinforce the economic advantages they have. And conversely, poor people and workers organized in labor unions are more likely to support the Liberal Party, which in the U.S. has been the Democratic Party, again, because the economic policies that are pursued and the policies on social justice are more likely to benefit people of low income or who face income insecurity. Jews, as no doubt Professor Chiswick emphasized, on average tend to be high earners and occupy high status positions. Again, they're more like Episcopalians and Congregationalists and Unitarians than they are, say, Baptists or other groups. Yet, nonetheless, they have consistently tended to hold positions on voting, on economic issues, and on social issues that just don't look like the people who they resemble socioeconomically.
Yeah, I want to press you a little bit on this issue, and this takes us into the political science area for right now. So those of you who are deeply interested in religion, you just might have to hold on here for a second. But I've always been curious about that association between wealth and or income and voting behavior, since it's often posited as being a unilinear line, that the wealthier you are, the more likely you're going to vote Republican or be conservative, favor various economic policies that would be associated with conservative political positions. But it doesn't, if you just kind of think this through in a casual way, the Democratic Party actually has a number of really big-time wealthy donors that are affiliated with them, as well as other leftist groups, say, such as Emily's List. And then, likewise, if you flip that coin over, I think it was the journalist Thomas Frank who wrote a book that poorer blue-collar folks tend to vote more conservative in a much more conservative direction. I think the name of that book was What's the Matter with Kansas? He looked at a bunch of poor Kansans and say, hey, you know, socioeconomically, you folks should be running to the Democratic Party. But Kansas, you never do that. You're a red state. So what are your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, it's interesting. There is no question that when we as political scientists make statements about political behavior, those statements are probabilistic and that they don't apply to everybody with equal force. And indeed, that's true in my whole claim about Jews and politics. For example, when I talk about Jews being liberal, people will often say, but wait a minute, I know so-and-so who's Jewish and affluent and he or she is highly Republican, or I know somebody who is Jewish and poor, and they nonetheless tend to vote Republican. You'll get some or, you know, you'll get variations and exceptions. And one of the ironies here is I actually grew up in a home that was both Jewish and Republican, so I'm an exception in terms of my socialization to the very rules that I talk about. But those exceptions typically don't invalidate the general pattern, and the overwhelming evidence suggests that, by and large, it's still the case that elections are what Seymour Martin Lipset, another scholar, once described as democratic expressions of class struggle, that we do find overall that income and occupational status is a fairly good or are fairly good predictors of voting, and generally of attitudes as well. Now, I think in the United States that was less true in the 1970s when Everett Carl Ladd, a very prominent political scientist who really wrote like a journalist, talked about the inversion of the New Deal order when he said that on many social issues and questions about the Vietnam War, you actually had higher status people being more liberal and working class Americans being more conservative. So certainly this class difference or status difference isn't universal across time, but as a general rule, it still holds true. If you want to predict a person's vote, their socioeconomic status is one of the variables you really need to have in that equation.
Yeah. How does education play a role in that? And you mentioned the 1970s where you saw that inversion of the New Deal order. And, you know, I think, too, when I look at some of this data, that education, as you tend to become more educated, and that tends to be highly correlated with your income, obviously, and your professional status. But once you get to a certain point, college, just, you know, postgraduate work, you tend to see people who, with postgraduate degrees tend to skew left. Could that be at work here, too?
I don't doubt that that's one component of the overall process. What I have found in looking at this literature is that those of high education and often high income do tend to be more liberal on some of the social issues, questions about homosexuality, drug use, gender roles, and so forth. Those attitudes tend to be pretty clearly liberalized by education and therefore to correlate with income. But when you get into the realm of economic policy and the kinds of questions that are really at the center of the political agenda, you don't tend to find that much of a pattern. And so in recent elections where, you know, we've largely had referenda upon the state of the economy and taxes and welfare and so forth, you tend to find, again, that higher income and higher education tend to pull in the same direction on vote choice. So partly depends which issues you're talking about.
Okay.
What makes Jews peculiar is that, you know, Episcopalians tend to be, to use that comparison group, quite liberal on social issues, even though they're high income. But when you look at them on economic issues, they're very much committed to the Republican line. And Jews, on the other hand, who are like Episcopalians, are liberal on both of those issues.
Yeah, that's interesting. Well, I guess that brings us to the issue of Jews here too. And I guess I have one more question too about the data. And we talk about things in a probabilistic term, and you mentioned also that the data that we have on Jews is oftentimes hard to come by because it's a small segment of the population. But have you been able to see any difference between the types of Jews who vote, say, Orthodox or ultra-Orthodox versus Reform Jews, and how they fall along this spectrum?
Yeah, within the Jewish community, there's no question that Jews who are part of what's called the ultra-Orthodox tradition and those who are part of what we call the modern Orthodox tradition are less politically liberal than Jews who are either conservative, which is a religious rather than a theological, rather than a political position, or Reform, or the vast majority of Jews who don't identify with any of those movements. Clearly, there is some difference as you go from the more secular to the more deeply observant Jews on a range of issues, and that cleavage is clearly there, and you see it in presidential voting, and you see it as well in some other political attitudes. But what is striking about this is how the gradient is so much less steep than the equivalent gradient when you look at non-Jews, particularly at Christians. I just recently published a piece on attitudes to gay marriage using an unusually large data set from something called the 2004 Annenberg National Election Study, which was about a year and a half long survey and asked a series of detailed questions. And the striking thing is when you looked at Jews, even Jews who were at the highest level of religiosity were much more supportive of gay marriage than their non-Jewish counterparts who were identical on all other traits, income, education, and so forth and so on. So the gradient is there in terms of religiosity, where the more you're inclined to traditional forms of Jewish observance, you are going to be less liberal and more likely to vote Republican. But it's not as dramatic as you see it when you look at other populations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's pretty good to keep in mind here. So we're dealing with this first puzzle here, which we're going to talk, again, in probabilistic terms, and we're going to be looking at Jews in America writ large, in essence. And the puzzle, again, is given their socioeconomic status, education, all the other what I call usual suspects thrown into the mix, they tend to vote more liberal than other groups in society. Now, how have we've known this for a long time. So how have other scholars tried to explain this?
Right. Other scholars have usually given what I describe as Judaic theories, which argue that there's something intrinsic in Judaism or the Jewish experience which makes Jews inclined to the left politically, and which then manifests itself as voting for the Democrats or holding liberal political views in American politics. And I should point out that I myself have, you know, for decades taught these theories to my students, and I do think there is some utility to them. But the three theories, generally, one focuses on Jewish values, and it particularly emphasizes a value known as tzedakah, or charitableness, that charity is considered a moral obligation that one has, and being kind to the widow and the orphan, to use biblical language, is often considered a mark of a person's religious piety. And it goes along with other values, a value on learning, a value on challenging accepted norms, all of which the assumption goes has a kind of what, to use Tocqueville's language, would be an elective affinity with a more liberal position in political life. There's the Jewish history argument, which is something of a variation here, and it argues that particularly if you look at the history of European Jews in the period known as emancipation, which is essentially 19th through early 20th centuries in Europe, when Jews for the first time were treated as citizens and were not put in the position of having to give up their Judaism in order to participate in society. That battle, which occurred in different forms in different countries, tended to range in opposition. You had groups like the monarchy, the military, big business, the establishment, as it were, of most societies, which didn't want Jews to have those rights. And on the other hand, you tended to have labor unions, socialists, those who challenged the status quo, who as part of that orientation tended to strongly support Jewish emancipation. And the argument is that American Jews today kind of learned from that experience. That was their heritage. They tended to distrust those on the right who formed part of the establishment and to favor those on the left. And so, again, the argument is our contemporary politics, where Jews vote left, is a kind of echo of the loyalties and attachments that Jews developed as a result of their history. And there's a final explanation, which is something of a variation on that theme, which I call the minority consciousness argument. Even though American Jews may have high levels of socioeconomic status, prestige, and accomplishment in the United States, this argument goes their history has tended to make them very skeptical and suspicious of the degree to which they are accepted by society at large. So Jews may look to everybody else as part of the establishment, but in their own mind they still think of themselves as vulnerable outsiders. The problem of American Jews, Abba Ibn, the former late Israeli foreign secretary, once said, is that American Jews can't take yes for an answer.
Yeah.
They live in a society where they have a level of freedom and accomplishment just undreamed of in Jewish history, but they still think of themselves as forever at the mercy of an essentially anti-Semitic public. And so the argument goes, again, to tie it to politics, that Jews think of themselves as a minority and thus identify naturally with other oppressed minorities. So when American Jews thought about the civil rights movement of African Americans in the 1960s or the gay rights movement of the 1980s, in both cases they saw these are people who are like us and therefore who deserve our support and sympathy. So these are the three conventional explanations for American Jewish liberalism.
Now, before we get to your explanation, which I, again, you not saying that none of these explanations are necessarily wrong. They have some elements of truth to them. But again, you're trying to build a theory that links some of these other puzzles in. And that's where I want to turn us to your second puzzle here, which is basically that if you look at Jews in the United States, yes, they tend to skew liberal. But if you go beyond the boundaries of the United States, that's not the case. So tell us, give us a little comparative basis of what liberal Jews look like compared to their brethren in other parts of the world.
Yeah, you know, if you would go back to the early part of the 20th century and into the 1950s and maybe even 1960s, in most countries where there was a sizable Jewish community that had democratic political options, you would probably find most Jews to be on the left politically because they were immigrants, because they were freshly removed from the history of persecution and the like. So if you looked at data from, you know, France, Britain, Canada, Australia, South Africa, places like that, in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s, you would see Jews more on the left. But the striking thing is that they have moved away, for the most part, from that pattern. And the patterns vary a lot from country to country. In some places, Jews are fairly evenly divided between the left and the right. That's often the case in France. In some places like Canada, Jews divide politically between the parties in almost exactly the same proportion as Canadians as a whole do. In Australia and South Africa, in Australia, Jews are strikingly to the right of the rest of Australian population. And you get somewhat different patterns in South Africa and Britain. If you look at Israel, which is probably a very challenging comparison because it exists in such a different environment, you nonetheless find that the rank and file of Jews have become quite right-wing on a range of political issues. There, I don't want to overemphasize the unity of Israeli Jews because they are politically very divided on many issues. But certainly they are less focused on liberal values having to do with minority group rights. They are less likely to favor peaceful negotiations because they're simply less confident those will work than would be true of American Jews.
Yeah, they're the majority in there, so not surprising you're going to see a wide range of people on the spectrum as they place themselves there. But as you mentioned, if you take that distribution, they're going to be a little bit more to the right than their American counterparts.
Precisely. And again, if the behavior of American Jews was the result of these universal impulses in Judaism, impulses coming from a religious tradition, impulses coming from historical experiences of emancipation and also from, you know, being a minority in a predominantly non-Christian environment, you would expect very few differences among Jews politically depending on where they live. Yet the fact that we have them suggests that this Jewish liberalism is essentially an American phenomenon, not something that I think Judaic explanations really help us explain. That's why that initial set of theories is, to my mind, insufficient to explain the full range of this behavior.
Yeah, that comparative perspective, and again, you've written not only about religion in the United States, but you're also an expert in Israeli politics as well as British politics. So you have that nice comparative aspect of it, and as you say, it really puts those three conventional explanations to the test and show some of their limitations in that regard. There's one other one that's associated with your third puzzle here that takes us back within the United States, and that's the temporal variation that you notice from roughly about the 1960s to present. What is going on in Jewish political attitudes and voting behavior and over the last 40 or 50 years or so?
Yeah, as I said, there is this period of time, and again, it's a little hard to see exactly, but it's from roughly the early 1970s through the late 1980s. And what happens there is you get a variety of changes in society which tend to make it look like Jews are, in fact, going to move fairly decisively toward the right politically. And part of this has to do with the capture of the Democratic Party by the McGovern movement in 1972, and then the nomination of Jimmy Carter, who certainly wasn't one of the traditional kinds of Democratic nominees in 76 and so forth and so on. You have concerns, I think, about a number of issues. There is growing tension between Jews and African Americans, tensions which I think manifest themselves in the Democratic Party, and and which caused some Jews to wonder if their needs will be met in a party that has so, in the eyes of at least Jews, decisively embraced the cause of African Americans. And tensions over things like affirmative action, which to many Jews is particularly problematic because it reminds them of the quotas that used to keep Jews out of the best schools, the best jobs, the best neighborhoods, and so forth and mm-hmm. so on. You also have some real political tension in New York growing out of several particular incidents. There was a famous conflict over the school system in the Ocean Hill Brownsville section of the Bronx, where you had Jews and blacks very much pitted against each other on who should teach in black schools, who should be the superintendents, and so forth and so on. You had a perception that on the left there was growing hostility to Israel after the Six-Day War. Many Jews strengthened their identification with Israel because of that experience, but for many on the left, it seemed that it wasn't a David and Goliath situation. If anything, David was the Palestinians, and Israel was now the Goliath. So you had a number of things which raised questions among Jews about whether that alliance, traditional alliance with the Democrats and the left, was still in their political interests. And you began to see some narrowing of the political differences, particularly by 1980, the differences between Jews and non-Jews just in the Democratic vote, even if you add the John Anderson vote to that side, is much narrower than it was before. And really, up until the late 80s, you had a blurring of those political differences. And I think some genuine thought that American Jews might have moved decisively or were in the process of moving decisively to the right.
Yeah, something interesting, as you mentioned, the McGovern movement in the early 1970s in the Democratic Party, and we've talked about this on some of our previous podcasts. Not only, as you mentioned, did it give a number of Jews a pause to think about, okay, which direction is the Democratic Party going in? It's taking some policy positions that we might not be comfortable with. It did the same thing to evangelical Christians. And this, by the 1980s, you know, many people have argued that this really pushes evangelical Christians to the Republicans in many ways, that people have argued that the evangelicals capture, or the Christian right captures, a significant portion of the Republican Party during this period of time. And it might have only been tempered by the fact that in the 1970s, you had the Republican scandal with Watergate, a lot of disillusionment with the party there, worries about corruption, and then the evangelical president, Jimmy Carter. The evangelical saying, okay, he's a Democrat, but, you know, he's one of us. And, right. you know, we've had Nixon, and, well, he might not have been one of us. So that, in the 1970s, we see a lot of, you know, shifting ground in that regard. And then, as you mentioned in your paper, in the 1980s, this trend toward Jews moving to the right, especially by the late 1980s, reverses itself and they move back to the left again. And does that have anything to do with the Christian right, or what else might be going on here?
Yeah, I think there's no question. I mean, when you look at the plot of Jewish Democratic voting over time and compare it to non-Jews, you get this massive scissoring apart that begins in 88 but really hits its peak in 92 and has maintained itself through 2008 and I suspect through the 2010 congressional elections as well, although we don't yet have the data that enables us to reach that conclusion. And to my mind, without any question, it is Jewish concern about what they see as the takeover of the Republican Party by evangelical Christians through the Christian right that fundamentally alters the trend in Jewish political behavior. Some of it is, I think, because some of the issues that have been so prominent in the 70s, crime, affirmative action, things that I think were more important and anti-Israel sentiment, things that I think were much more important to Jews than they were to evangelicals, those issues began to wane a bit. But as the evangelicals, again, responded to their dissatisfaction by becoming active in the Republican Party, they often promoted an agenda that many Jews felt was profoundly threatening to Jewish existence in the United States.
And that brings us to your explanation that takes us back historically to the founding period, that really ties these three different paradoxes or puzzles together. So why don't you go ahead and elaborate, what do you think is going on here to explain these three different puzzles, the relative liberalness of American Jews, their comparative liberalness in the United States, and then finally this temporal variation that we see playing out through the 70s, 80s, and 90s.
Right. Well, I go back to the point that I made earlier, that Jews in the United States have, from a very early stage, really celebrated the United States. People have described it as their Zion, their New Jerusalem, not so much focusing on Israel as the place where a Jew has to go to live a full life. But Jews have really had a love affair with the United States. And that love affair is largely based on the perception by American Jews that they have thrived in America as they have thrived nowhere else, precisely because the United States has, from the very beginning, had a classically liberal, what I call, regime of religion and state. That is, classical liberalism, as it developed in the 18th and 19th century, took the position that government has no competence in matters of religion, and therefore a person's status under the law, his or her citizenship, is in no way or should in no way be affected by their religious affiliation, and in general, the state should be neutral in all matters having to do with religion. To American Jews, this has been their critical experience. And as I observed, this is something that Jews found almost from the beginning in the United States Constitution. It wasn't, as many people assume, in the First Amendment, although the religion clause there is very important. It was in an otherwise obscure part of Article 6 of the Constitution, which, in a kind of a residual paragraph that covered lots of issues, said that under the new federal government, there shall be no religious tests for holding public office. Prior to this time, and in most of the colonies that are now become states, there were religious tests for holding public office. In some places, the religious test effectively barred Catholics. In some places, it effectively barred evangelicals and other dissenters from certain Protestant doctrines. But in most places, it barred Jews, Muslims, and non-believers from holding public office. And so when the Constitutional Convention met, the Jewish communities in the United States that were very small really lobbied hard to get language in the Constitution that would forbid such religious oaths or requirement for public office. Because to them, that is what made them real citizens. And when the Constitution was passed with that such a provision, American Jews saw it as their Magna Carta. And really, ever since then, their overwhelming political goal has been to maintain that system in which religion is not seen as a fit matter for government action and certainly not for citizenship. So my argument is that the core Jewish political value has been keeping alive this regime of religion and state. And when that regime, and again, two reasons this addresses the other two puzzles. First of all, it addresses the core puzzle of why Jews tend to vote for the left, because they generally see the left as more committed than the right to maintaining this regime that separates religion and state so powerfully. And I think that's a historically accurate assessment. Mm-hmm. Generally speaking, liberals, Democrats, and the like are more likely to see religion as not being relevant to the operation of government or the status of citizens. But it's a unique situation that Jews in the United States alone face. Even in democratic societies like Britain, Canada, France, and so forth, you don't have that full extent of liberal political systems, and Jews, frankly, can never hope to be completely equal because those countries still have legal systems which benefit the traditional or established religion or overwhelming majorities that kind of make those values central to the way society operates. So it's why American Jews in particular worship, in a sense, the separation of religion and state and that whole regime of that we have here. And it also, in my mind, explains what I see as the variations over time, because if you go back to the period when American Jews started to waver politically in the late, or in the 1970s through the 1980s, a number of things were happening that seemed to be challenging that traditional separation of religion and state and that whole idea of the law being neutral here. Affirmative action was seen, in the words of some Jews, as affirmative discrimination reinforced by law, which violates the logic of a liberal political system. And certainly when the Christian right emerged in the 1990s, it was seen as pushing a very sectarian, a very Christian-oriented national identity that, for all the protestations of support and respect for Jews, which I accept, nonetheless struck Jews as fundamentally returning them or attempting to return them to a second-class status. So in my mind, this critical regime of religion and state that Jews embrace really tends to explain their politics, their movement over time, and why it's such an American as opposed to a more cross-national phenomenon.
You bring up an important point there, and I think a certain irony, that when the Christian right and the moral majority in the 1980s and then the Christian coalition in the 1990s, they went out of their way to embrace Israel. And one would automatically think that, well, you know, that the Jews should then really be voting Republican just as they are because they're embracing this. But, you know, and many people have puzzled, well, why hasn't this been the case? But, you know, what you're saying here and is explaining that is, along with that, is this movement back toward, you know, the Christian right perhaps capturing the government and moving away from that separation of church and state. So on the one hand, yeah, great, you're supporting Israel. We might like that. We might not. But, you know, the way that you're doing this is alienating us. So you're talking one area here, but really have a blind side to this complete other dialogue that we've been having historically.
Yeah, it's kind of ironic. The late Rabbi Alexander Schindler, a major force in Reform Judaism, was quoted in the 1980s as saying, quote, "When I hear the words Christian America, a common phrase used by evangelicals, I see barbed wire." And it sort of relates to the fact that people who talk in language that fuses God and the nation, or religion and the nation, are in effect on the slippery slope to punishing, if not actually exterminating, those who do not hold the same degree of faith. And that's obviously an extreme example of that sentiment, but I think it reflects what's almost a reflex among many American Jews. It was a reason I think many were nervous about Jimmy Carter, his propensity to engage in what we call as God talk, something that's much more common among evangelicals than it is among Jews, clearly makes Jews extremely nervous. The Israel side of it is an interesting part. You note that particularly after the Six-Day War, evangelicals in America got fascinated by Israel and saw it as its victory in the Six-Day War as a harbinger of Jesus' return. It had a parallel effect among some Israelis who saw it as also the indication of the return of the Messiah, but they had a somewhat different Messiah in mind.
Right.
But it was really interesting to observe that you're right, evangelicals became very committed to Israel, and frankly, much more hawkish and right-wing than most American Jews, who are quite divided about Israel's policy. So part of the reason I think the embrace of Israel by the evangelicals didn't work is that many American Jews don't share the particular policy preferences that the evangelicals have for Israel. Many Jews also see the evangelical embrace of Israel as, to use the language of social science, instrumental. If you go through the book of Revelation, which guides this, theologically, which guides this embrace of Israel and sees it as the harbinger of the return of the Messiah, what happens to the Jews isn't very positive from a Jewish perspective.
Yeah,
you know, they're killed, and the few who remain repent, which in Jewish eyes means they leave Judaism. So much of the reason for the embrace of Israel was seen to be as at its core, ironically, anti-Semitic. And there are other reasons as well. But you're quite right, it is an irony that just as evangelicals and Jews might have found common ground on defense of Israel, other factors just were much more important in pushing Jews away from evangelicals, and therefore, I would argue, away from Republicans.
Yeah. I want to push you, and this is kind of thinking forward here in this regard. You're giving a fairly deep historical explanation for these three puzzles that extends over, you know, 200 years. It goes back to the founding of America and the preference for a separation of church and state. But I'm wondering, to what extent does that get passed down from generation to generation? And I'm thinking back to our discussion last week that we had with Carmel Chiswick, is that one of the dynamics occurring with the Jewish community as they become more economically and educationally integrated into the United States is that they start to move out of the ghetto and they start finding themselves in suburban America, and in many ways, because they're a minority community, they have less contact with Jews around them. That, you know, nowadays you might live out in suburbia and there might not be anybody within 5 or 6 blocks of you who is a Jew. You're the only one there. And this has its effects on intermarriage and a number of other factors here. Is it possible that some of these ideas or some of this tradition or, you know, the long historical memory is starting to fade among the younger generations?
Well, it's interesting. I think on the one hand, that's, you sort of assume that the influence of these things becomes less dramatic as time passes and people's experiences change. But to some extent, these attitudes, I think, tend to be reinforced by particular events. So let's take, for example, the year 2000, when Al Gore selects Joe Lieberman as his vice presidential nominee. For many young Jews, that really seemed to reinforce their parents' tendency to see the Democrats as the party that's good for the Jews and that Jews are attached to. Now, ironically, Lieberman, as we know, was more conservative than most Jews and most Democrats, but nonetheless, there was this very powerful and palpable sense of identification that I really saw quite dramatically among my students. Mm-hmm. And then I think you had a shift in the opposite direction in 2008, when early polls had suggested that Jews had a lot of trouble with Barack Obama. They were concerned about whatever Muslim roots he might have, and that's obviously a matter of some debate. And he was an unknown quantity for them, so the fact that his name was, you know, Barack Hussein Obama did exert some concern. And there was some discussion that this might be an election where Jews, particularly young Jews, would turn heavily toward the Republican Party. Well, that might have happened, but John McCain made the choice to nominate Sarah Palin as his vice presidential nominee, and her anchor in the fundamentalist wing of Protestant Christianity and her attendance at churches that talked about the need to convert Jews really pushed many young Jews even more heavily in the Democratic direction and sort of slowed dramatically whatever trend there had been among Jews. So the gap between Jews and non-Jews in presidential voting in 2008 was as wide as it had been in the previous 4 elections. So I think to some extent events do conspire to sort of re-socialize young people and keep these things very much awake in that kind of understanding. The other thing is while I appreciate, you know, Chiswick's general argument, some demographers have done some very interesting work, and they make the argument that the social transformation of American Jews, the embrace of education and access to education, you know, from the 1950s on, and the move to suburbia and the opening up of the occupational structures, happened so quickly to Jews that they actually sort of experienced it as a group phenomenon. And many Jews found themselves living in the same suburbs, attending the same universities, working in the same kinds of occupations. So, in fact, they weren't nearly as isolated as one might imagine. Granted, this wasn't the urban ghetto that Jews once inhabited, but they, in a sense, could be quasi-ghettoized environments anyway. And so that may have mitigated some of the change that would have happened had Jews really been isolated. But Jews still tend to concentrate in particular areas, particular occupations, and the like, which I think has the effect of reinforcing these political orientations.
Mm-hmm. Have you noticed any exceptions to your theories? Any, you know, bumps in the road that you might have to investigate a little bit further?
Yeah, there are two groups, frankly, where my general approach doesn't work very well among Jews. And one we've already mentioned: those who are Orthodox, and particularly those who are ultra-Orthodox. And clearly are much less prone to be liberal than their peers. And as I've argued before, this is, I think, in my mind, essentially because they're not as driven by the goal to be fully part of American life and to be accepted as such. They're not troubled, in some sense, to be apart from the United States. And so this separation of religion and state, which guarantees that for many Jews, is not just simply as important to them. They don't mind the state having a religious character if it means they might have more resources. They might, for example, have tuition tax credits they can use to send their children to Jewish day schools or other sort of Jewish environments. So they clearly are one of the exceptions to this rule. The other group where the model doesn't seem to fit, although it's more impressionistic at this point, are the sizable number of Jews from the former Soviet Union who migrated to the United States primarily in the 90s and the first decade of the 21st century. These communities tended to settle in large numbers in traditional Jewish centers, places like New York, places like Los Angeles on the West Coast. And there's some evidence that these Jews from the former Soviet Union have been courted, and some of them have moved into the Republican Party. The argument is their experience of socialism tends to make them quite conservative across a range of issues. My suspicion here is first of all, we don't really know how widespread this is because we have very limited data. My suspicion is that if this is the case, it's probably a one-generation phenomenon, and I would expect that by the second generation, some of the changes that we've seen, again, suburbanization, affluence, and the like, are probably going to make a difference and move the next generation more into the typical Jewish pattern. But to be candid, we don't know. But those two groups are the ones that I think are least well explained by this theory.
Yeah. One of the other things that I was thinking about here as we've been discussing this as an exception, and you don't address this directly in your paper, so I'm really asking you to step outside of the research that you've been doing here and to do a little bit of speculation, are Mormons. And Mormons, you know, when I think about it, they've had a pretty intense history of persecution in the United States, having been chased through Ohio and Illinois and all the way out to the Great Basin. Yet today we see them as some of the most staunchest Republican and conservative voters around. I mean, you can always count on Utah going to the Republican Party in any given presidential election. What do you think about that? What is there something different in their experience? Because one would think, just going through your theory, that, well, you know, they want that separation of church and state because, again, if those conservative evangelicals get a hold of the government, well, we're going to see what we saw back in the early 1800s.
Well, you know, you don't have to just limit it to Mormons. I mean, it's a general case that other groups that have a history of discrimination and persecution on religious grounds have not necessarily moved to the left, and one could argue that American Catholics may be an even better example. There was a time in America when to be a Catholic was to be consigned to a kind of a second-class existence and having all sorts of opportunities for education and advancement to be limited. That changed largely as a result of World War II and the GI Bill, and not surprisingly, white Catholics in particular moved fairly dramatically to the right as a consequence of that pattern. So I don't think it's religious persecution in and of itself that matters. I think what matters, frankly, is whether or not the group being persecuted can see itself as part of the religious majority or not. And the thing that unites both Catholics and Mormons is that they self-identify as Christians.
Mm-hmm.
Mormons insist that they are not, in fact, different from the core of the majority of other Americans and their religious values. They have unique beliefs that make them Mormon, but they very much consider themselves to be part of the Christian tradition in the United States. And Catholics obviously make that argument as well. So defining the United States religiously, provided that religion is Christianity, is probably not as threatening to Catholics and Mormons as it would be to Jews. I think the interesting group would be in time to see how Mormons and Hindus, who are, you know, two of the fastest growing American religious groups, and the other two groups that are not Christian, one is Abrahamic, one is not, but nonetheless, how they react and how they come to define their political agenda. And I think it's much too soon to see that. We're really just talking about groups that have grown in large numbers since the 1960s and the changes of immigration. But they may actually provide an even more interesting test, if I'm right, that it's not religious persecution per se. It's the question of which religion is seen as dominant and therefore defining the bounds of privilege and prestige.
Yeah, that's interesting to think about future research projects that either you can conduct or maybe there's some graduate student out there searching around for a dissertation topic. This would be a good stream of thought to follow up upon in that regard. I want to finish off again, and you do this at the end of your paper and engage in a little bit of speculation. And you know, academics always tread dangerously on thin ice when they get into the realm of speculation, but nonetheless, I think there's something inherent in our characteristic that we can't avoid it. So I'm going to let you go ahead and speculate here about what do you think about the future trajectory of American Jewish voting behavior? We talked a little bit about 2010. You didn't think that much would have changed during that election for Jews in specific. Maybe some thoughts on that and go out perhaps a decade or so. What do you see on the horizon there?
Yeah, I frankly, you know, it's funny. I have been speaking to Jewish audiences about this topic probably for 15 years, almost as soon as I began doing research on it. And, you know, if I had a nickel for every time somebody had told me that Jews were becoming Republicans, that this era of Democratic and liberal attachment was a fluke and it was ending, I'd be a rich person. And I have actually made some money betting against these approaches.
Mm-hmm.
I should point out, in legal bets with British bookmakers.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah.
over the decades. And again, I was told in no uncertain terms that this pattern would come crashing to a halt in 2008. And yet, at the end of the day, Jews split about 80-20 in favor of Barack Obama over John McCain. So I am more impressed by the forces that make for stability than those that make for change. I think at some point the really interesting phenomenon that we're all talking about today is, of course, the Tea Party. And some people see the Tea Party as supplanting the Christian conservative movement in terms of its influence on American public life, and therefore, in a sense, reducing what Jews see as the threatening group. But the question, of course, has been raised, to what extent is there overlap between the two movements? And we have fairly fragmentary research at this point, and it suggests that some places the Christian right and the Tea Party are essentially indistinguishable. And certainly if you look at somebody like Michelle Bachmann, who is considered one of the major Tea Party representatives, or if you look at Sarah Palin, their deep roots in evangelical Protestantism and the compatibility of Tea Party views with these kinds of fundamentalist Christian views is very easy to see. And in that sense, there will be no change. If the Tea Party persists and if it develops a very different profile in the public eyes, then it might, in fact, change some of the threat and bring the Jewish vote into play again. But I'm betting against that. I see much more stability than I see the likelihood of change here.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll have to track your British betting houses to see how you do in the coming years and how those predictions play out. I do think you're right. I really buy into your explanation, and I think it's one that's historically rooted, and I've always liked historically rooted political science explanations, but one that really matches well with the contemporary survey data in that regard. And we'll keep in touch with you as your book progresses and see if you reinforce those beliefs or if you make any changes, and we'll stay in contact. With that, I want to remind our folks that coming up next week, we're also going to continue on the theme of Judaism in a rather interesting way. We'll be talking with Catholic theologian Brant Petrie, talking about the Jewish roots of the Eucharist. And it was a great interview that we had just recently conducted before this one, and I'm airing it after this so I could match Ken's podcast with Carmel Chiswick. So it's one that I think that our listeners will be really fascinated with. And so the month of May is going to have a great number of podcasts, and we hope that you tune in, subscribe to us on iTunes, and connect with us on Facebook. And that about concludes it for us. So Ken, I want to thank you for being on Research on Religion.
Well, thank you. I want to thank you for hosting this series. It's a wonderful service, and certainly for inviting me.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.